This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town, your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
Do you still have your copy of Cookery the Australian Way from Home Ec? Do you remember what you learnt to cook in home economics? And is that actually how you learnt your basic cooking skills? So in a time now where many of our kids are staying at home longer and maybe don't have the need to be able to cook for themselves like we had to, why is interest growing? Food study enrolments across the state are on the rise. It's now amongst the top five fastest growing VCE subjects. So from living at home until you're, I don't know, maybe 30 to ordering Uber Eats, do your kids know how to cook? And is cooking still seen as an important life skill? And at around 11:30 this morning, we'll also be asking whether or not you should be able to take carer's leave at work for your sick or for your dying pet. Paternity leave. It's a thing.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So if you've got a heap of cookbooks, amongst them is Cookery the Australian Way there. Remember it? In Home Ec? And is that how you learnt to cook? And if you look now at your teens, 16, 17, 18-year-old, maybe even in their early 20s, if they're still living at home, do they know how to cook? Well, food study enrolments across the state are on the rise. Food studies is now in the top five fastest growing VCE subjects. So maybe there's a young person in your home who's studying food tech. And one of them may be the students of Natalie Murray. She is the food studies teacher from Ringwood Secondary College. And Natalie, a lot of your students, first things first, have got perfect scores. So congratulations. But many of them attribute their love of cooking and just food studies to you, so we'll get to more of that in just a moment. But is food studies more than just learning how to boil an egg and make lasagna?
Hi, Rochelle. Thank you. It definitely is well beyond and a lot more complex than simply the cooking. Those practical aspects are certainly an important part of what we try to teach the students, and that's at the very beginnings of food studies in Year 8. And by the time we sort of reach those senior levels, it's about empowering our consumers or students to be able to make healthy, informed choices and be aware of what's going on in our food system. How can they be ethical? How can they be sustainable in their choices and nourish themselves for life as well?
So, Natalie, you've spoken about how food studies is that, yeah, crossroads between nutrition and sustainability, science, and then there is just the love and the art of cooking itself. But why do you think, I mean, to be in the top five fastest growing subjects for VCE, why is that, do you think?
I think when the food studies course was first implemented in 2017, which was quite a drastic shift from the food and technology course that was previously, it really attracted a more diverse range of students who could perhaps relate with it more at a real life relative level. And in terms of the students who would be choosing it now, it could be that they're simply interested in this general knowledge. You still get some students who would be interested in an industry pathway, but you also get the nutrition students or even those that are perhaps passionate about health and fitness that would like that nutrition edge as well.
So the interest in it, is it about life skills, do you think? And for some students, I know I was reading, they were saying, look, it is a nice break. It's not as stressful as some of the other subjects and I get great life skills as a result. Or is it seen as a career, as a career pathway? Because it's not necessarily just jobs in hospitality because, you know, I wouldn't probably not always encourage people to get into hospitality. It's not that well paid. It's hard working. But it's beyond that, isn't it?
It is. Hospitality is just a small part of it, and there's certainly you have the other aspects or courses of kitchen hospitality, but food studies is definitely that, yes, I can relate to it in my life, but it's also an engaging way or course that encapsulates a student's engagement and attention where they're thoroughly enjoying that learning in both a theoretical point of view and a practical point of view. So I think that really differentiates our course and what makes it so appealing to students.
Sounds like you're at a concert, Natalie. Where are you? Are you at school?
Sorry, I am at school. I do apologise.
Don't apologise.
Just started happening.
School life must continue.
Unfortunately. I do apologise.
No,
for that.
Don't apologise. So if we were to walk into one of your classes, Natalie, what would we be learning?
So we learn a whole range of topics. We start with the physiology of eating and digesting food. So students will learn about the digestive system and how foods are broken down and absorbed in the body. We then also progress to things like the science of food, the factors that influence our food choice, healthy eating patterns and how those patterns are formed in and impact childhood, as well as the social and emotional roles that food plays in terms of our health and even our mental health, rather than just being something that we eat for the sake of it.
Well, your students absolutely love you and your style. Just finally, Natalie Murray is with you, food studies teacher from Ringwood Secondary College. Many of her students are getting perfect scores and loving being a part of food studies. What do you love about it, Nat? I mean, did you learn to cook at a young age?
I did. I had early experiences with cooking with my mum and my grandparents, and my background prior to teaching was in nutrition and health anyway. So I've always had that passion for the nutrition and health sort of aspects. And I just, it's a really fun course to teach, which I think perhaps, conveys that to the students, which is perhaps why they enjoy it as well.
Well, we're going to let you get to class. Thanks, Nat. See ya.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Natalie Murray is the food studies teacher there at Ringwood Secondary College. Her students are absolutely crushing it at the moment, but it's in the top five fastest growing subjects in VCE. Can you remember what you learned? I mean, it's different. Home ec to what food studies is now, it's very different. Maybe you've still got your copy of Cookery the Australian Way. When I moved out of home, I didn't even know how to boil rice. It was so embarrassing. It was a flatmate who taught me how to cook. He was this flamboyant, over-the-top, gorgeous Italian man. His mum was a great cook. He was a great cook. And he taught me how to cook. I rocked up to my first share household with my copy of Cookery the Australian Way. Probably still got it somewhere. Sally, good morning. Do you have your copy of Cookery the Australian Way somewhere?
I have two. I have one that was given to me by my boyfriend's mother in, I think, 1983. And I got the second one at a garage sale and that doted copy. And I absolutely love it.
I love that. I reckon if I saw it at a garage sale, oh, the memories that would come back. We were so poorly behaved in home economics. So I think our teacher left. I think we gave her some kind of emotional breakdown. But do you still use the cookbook?
Oh, all the time.
Really?
Yep, yep.
Which dishes?
The recipe to shepherd's pie. One of my favourites from there.
With peas? Does it have peas in it?
Peas and corn,
It's like a cuddle, shepherd's pie, isn't it? If food could give you a cuddle, that's a...
And it, you know, when you forget, it's like it's all going to be set out in Cookery the Australian Way. I was at high school in the 70s and we also had a book called Introduction to Cooking, and I have the copy of that, which is from, like, I think it was published in about 1973 or something like that. And they're so easy to follow the recipes. That's what
I
love.
Simple. Yeah. And I think, do you think, Sally, finally, because I actually want to have a chat to Belinda Hudak, who's the president of the Victorian Australian Association's state secondary principals, about whether or not it's an important life skill. So just knowing your way around the kitchen, is it important now? Because now you can order whatever you want and people are staying at home longer. Maybe dad or mum or siblings are cooking for you. Is it still seen as important, do you think?
I think so, yes. Yeah. It's just such a basic skill.
That's nice.
Even though you can order food in, it's not always going to be exactly what you want.
That's right, and it's so expensive to be able to do that. Good on you, Sally. I'm great that you still got those copies. This, Rish, yep, I've still got Cookery the Australian Way. Still use it for the boiled fruitcake. It's the best. I use it over Christmas time. Yep, I kept that book for years. The Welsh Rabbit is what I cook from it. Home Ec or Food Tech back in the mid-90s. I took classes just so I could eat in class. That's BJ, I know. Remember when you'd get on the bus to go home and you'd have Food Tech or Home Ec and you'd have scones or lasagna or whatever it is. Oh, you were everyone's best friend on the bus. All of a sudden the tech boys wanted to sit next to you. Belinda, no, actually let's have a chat to John. Good morning, John.
Good morning. I'm a child of a country high school where unfortunately the boys were deemed to be the chaps who would have to go and do steel fabrication and engine repairs and stuff, and we weren't allowed to do home economics.
You weren't allowed?
No. No, that was women's business. But fortunately, when I turned 25, a friend of mine gave me a copy of Cookery the Australian Way. And it is now still, and I'm now coming up for 70, it's my go-to cookbook, and I love it.
It's a good one, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's basic, but it's got all of the ingredients in it. Wow, John, that you've taken me back, actually. I'm trying to think about how many boys were in my home ec class or whether they were off, you know, shoved off to do woodwork and we were shoved off to the kitchen. And, oh, how times have changed.
Yes, that's how it was, and that was just wrong. But anyway, we all got better.
And what's your dish? What's your signature dish at home now, John?
My grandchildren love the green tomato relish, which is in the back of the preserve section of the Cooker of the Australian Way.
Oh, you're winning friends
there. When the grandkids turn up, it's, can we have some of your green tomato relish, Pop? Yeah. Yes, of course you can.
of course you can.
I've been making that now for about 45 years or something.
Do you make it with them? Do they help out?
No, they just eat the stuff.
Yeah. It's quite arduous, isn't it? My mother-in-law used to make tomato chutney, and I used to sort of balk at paying because chutney can be expensive, pickles can be expensive. And then we tried to make it one year, and oh, by the time you peel the skins off and you've got to add everything and sterilize the jars, it's quite the mission. Now I don't mind paying a bit extra. Good on you, John. Thank you. Belinda Hudak is the president of the Victorian Association of State Secondary Principals. Belinda, I guess to John's point, please say it's not just girls that are taking up this, that we have a mix of genders.
No, we certainly have a mix of genders, and I think we have access right through secondary school for an access to food studies in different shapes and forms in the junior years of secondary schooling, some of which everyone has to try. And then as the students have more choice in their electives, we see students right across the board and certainly different genders choosing those food studies. When they get to year 11 and 12, they have much more smaller selection of subjects, often year 12 only having five subjects that they choose from. So it is great to see that there's an increase in that space.
So this is more than just cooking. Yes, we're talking about cooking, but food studies now, and when you look at the rise and the popularity around nutrition and diet and food science and just the world of opportunities that that opens up, do we need to sort of get our head out of the 1970s when we think food studies?
Yeah, absolutely. So when young people are studying food studies in year 11 and 12, you know, they're looking at everything from food security to food sovereignty, so understanding global issues around food supply. Then they're also understanding, you know, the things that we hear buzzwords all the time and fad diets and the things that, you know, are promoted particularly through social media or on the television about what we should eat all of a sudden and what we shouldn't eat. And, you know, things often in food trends come in and out of fashion. But this is a great opportunity for young people to really learn food science, which is understanding what all of those foods do, what carbs do to your body, you know, what protein does to your body, why it's important to have such a balanced diet, and what does it actually mean in today's society?
I wonder, wondering how schools are set up now and the equipment and resources that they have. I mean, there's a text here saying, I can still use my cookery the Australian way back from 1968, but at our high school we had a dedicated home economics wing. It had kitchens, it had sewing rooms. We learnt so much. Do we still, I mean, I can remember, I'm taken right back to all of those ovens and stovetops and the flour being thrown everywhere in the home ec room. Do we still have the space to teach these subjects?
Yeah, so schools do work hard to maintain their spaces to be able to deliver all prac subjects, whether that be in the trade-based areas, traditional trade-based areas, or whether it be in, youth food studies. And there is a difference between schools. Schools are delivering food studies, which is often in more of a domestic type kitchen, so in what you remember with the ovens and the traditional stovetops. But schools are also delivering hospitality and kitchen operations as vet subjects, and those setups in schools look a lot more like commercial kitchens. Looks like something off MasterChef in some cases.
So then that would be, I mean, do we have the teachers? Do we have the specialist teachers? I'm just wondering how the interest changes what teachers are studying.
Yeah, so I think that, as we said, food studies isn't just about cooking. It is really heavily about nutrition, and so there's a strong element to that. I think that kids do enjoy the fact there's a balance of practical and theoretical elements to the studies, but it is important that we see these teachers come through with those skills and look to be able to bring those specialised knowledge and area into particularly our VCE studies to develop those passions and that knowledge for our kids. So it's certainly difficult finding specialised teachers in certain areas, and that's getting harder and harder.
I've just been sent a text and it's taken me back to when you are the most popular on the school bus going home after home ec, and it was when you made this, the golden syrup dumplings from Cookery the Australian Way. And I had forgotten about those dumplings. I can almost taste them now. Belinda, how old were you when you learnt to cook?
Well, I pushed pretty hard back on having to do home ec at school, I must say. I wanted to do more performing arts subjects.
Yep.
I'm pretty sure I had my mum write me a note to say I didn't need to do food studies, and not unlike what you said earlier, left school not really knowing how to cook, but I could make fondant roses to put on the cake. But I do think that it's an important skill that you develop. But, yeah, I probably am not the poster child.
You eventually learn it. And, hey, look, sometimes we need a fondant rose. And if we do, we will give you a call.
Fantastic. I'll be there.
Belinda Hudak, the president of the Victorian Association of State Secondary Principals, talking about the fact that food studies is one of the fastest growing VCE subjects. Rish, I use my cookery the Australian way all the time. I'm 72. It's starting to fall apart. So yes, last year I found a good bookbinder and I actually had it fixed. And this, oh my God, I made corned beef last night and I used my secondhand copy of Cookery the Australian Way. I knew you guys would still have it. Morning, Rish. I used to work for Macmillan Educational Publishers for many years. Cookery the Australian Way was the best seller for donkey's years. We used to rub our hands together if there was ever a damaged palate, and we had a queue of adult friends who had their hand up for a freebie. That's from Lee. Ali's called through from Southwest Victoria. Good morning.
Oh, hello. Yes.
Yeah, good morning. You're on air.
I have a collection of different editions, I must admit, but I actually went to school and I hated cookery. I loved woodwork. Luckily, we got to do a bit of both, but I ended up becoming a woodwork teacher, and now near the end of my career, I moved into food tech, and so sometimes I just swap my welding apron for a food tech apron.
Wow.
But now with the advent of Stephanie Alexander kitchen gardens and things like that, it certainly is becoming much more widespread, and I think the kids are, it's really, really important.
That's right, and thank goodness we've moved beyond, boys do woodwork, girls do sewing or home ec, and to look at the different types of careers you can have through food tech as well. Thanks, Ali. Ash is in Reservoir. Morning.
G'day.
G'day.
G'day, Rish. I've got, because you were talking about Cookery the Australian Way, I'm holding in my hands my late mother's original copy, Cheryl Mitchell, Form 5, Domestic Sciences, Nearham South High, 1967, Cookery the Australian Way.
Wow.
So I've got the original edition. This was my mum's. She's dated on the opening page in 1967. It's edition one, 1966. It's all taped together. Interestingly, I also have the sixth edition from 1990-something, which I don't have in front of me, but they're very differently written because the original talks about everything being a woman's responsibility.
Oh, my goodness. And does it change over the decades?
Yes, there's no mention of it in the latest edition that I have, like page 23 here of the original Cookery, the Australian Way. As hostess, the housewife extends to her family the welcome and hospitality traditionally given to guests. In her planning, she must ensure not only that the meal is appetising, but is nutritionally adequate and within the family budget.
Oh,
in serving
goodness.
The meal pleasantly and attractively, she is contributing to the education of her children. That's on page 23 of the original edition, and it talks about the correct table linen, how the china and pottery should be set out, cutlery and silverware, table setting and table etiquette.
So not just plonking down in front of the tally and just eating, you know, with your hands. That's not going to quite cut it for that version. I love that you've got those copies. Ash, just quickly, do you cook anything from them?
Oh, I certainly do. Like if I'm doing my lamb roast, I'd want to do a lamb roast. The Aussie way, what am I going to do? I'm not quite sure. My cooking skills quite up to scratch. I'll just haul out a copy of Cookery the Australian Way.
I feel like I need to find my copy now too. Ash, thank you. I love that you have those copies. Keep those calls and texts coming through.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Coming up in about 10 minutes' time, should you be able to take carer's leave for your sick or for your dying or for bereavement of your pet? So there is a law firm that has paternity leave. Yes, paternity leave. So have you lied to an employer if you've had to take your cat or your dog or your rabbit or whatever to the vet if they're sick and you want to look after them? Or if you've had a pet die and you just want to grieve, have you been able to take time off? And should we legally be able to do that? That's coming up in just a moment as well. But around the globe at the moment, there is Super Bowl fever. Kate Mead, station reporter, has headed down to the city where one of Australia's largest NFL fans and about 1,000 of his closest mates are sitting there taking it all in. New England Patriots versus Seattle Seahawks. Kate, how many people have you got down there sort of taking in the Super Bowl at the moment?
Yeah, well, good morning, Rochelle. There is more than 1,000 people here. They've taken the day off work. And what is so special about this is the official NFL party, the official watch party tonight. I'm stepping outside. It's too ruckus in there. It's fantastic. It's absolutely fantastic. But this started really as one American dad about 15 years ago moved to Australia, and he had a couple of kids, and he was sitting around with the other dads and he was teaching them all about the NFL, and he wanted to make sure that they could love it as much as he did, to share in the excitement. So every year, he started hosting his own party. And it has now grown to the point where the NFL of Australia said, you know what, we love your party so much, let's make it an official thing and invite all of Melbourne. It nearly feels like all of Melbourne are in there. I think most of the blokes I've talked to would love this to be a public holiday. They may be pushing their luck.
Over the years, we've really sort of seen it grow and grow and grow, whether that be due to the halftime entertainment or the ads or just the fact that we do have more Australians that are playing now or who are trying to play and who are trying to get college sponsorships and scholarships. So I think it's the Seattle Seahawks who the punter is, Michael Dixon, that's who he plays for. Has there been much talk of sort of Aussies playing while you've been there?
Yeah, look, there has, and there's that real contingency of a lot of this community of Joes that he started are connected with these kids that are playing, and they're following them and they're championing them and they're fundraising for them if they need it to be able to make that step, because this is not a cheap sport to take on when you've got to move your whole life over to America to try and have a crack at one of the biggest leagues in the world. So it's a real community down here. And I tell you what I love, and I do get caught up in these moments, Rochelle, is just the super fanness of it all. And I'm not just seeing the two teams that are playing today. I'm seeing anyone that is an NFL fan are kind of here today. They want to party in the celebration of the year and watch the game. I said to one guy, you know, if you had to pick between the AFL Grand Final and the Super Bowl, you know, what are you picking? And he said, well, the Super Bowl is like Christmas, Kate. So it's very hard to compare.
And are you seeing a mix of, you know, locals, of men and women, young people, old people? Like, who's there watching?
Look, I'll be honest, I could count less than 20 females where
really?
I am. I'm on the bottom level where I am. But, you know, they've got their jerseys on and they know their football and they're there and they love it just as much as everyone else. It's kind of one of those situations where it kind of doesn't matter, male or female. Yes, there's a lot of males here, but they're just here for the game.
Well, have fun, Kate. So halftime hasn't happened yet. We haven't seen Bad Bunny take the stage. What are people looking forward to the most?
Yeah, it is Bad Bunny, and I had a laugh. There are people walking around with T-shirts on that just say, I'm just here for the halftime entertainment.
I reckon that's the case.
I can go sit with them.
Well, whatever gets you there, right? I don't know how many people have managed to get their day off. Have they all called in sick, I wonder?
Well, that's what I was asking. So some have been very honest with their bosses and their workplaces and said, you know, I'm American, or this is my day, you know, I have to have the day off. And others are like, well, you know, like we start at 8 o'clock. We'll be in bed by 4 o'clock this afternoon and we'll be right for tomorrow. So, you know, we'll just take a personal leave day.
Well, good luck. I think it will kind of get more boisterous and a little messier as the day goes on. Kate, so.
Yes, thank you.
Stay safe, right?
Thank you very much.
Kate Mead down at Hickens Hotel in the city, where the publican there, Joe Giblin, is one of Australia's largest NFL fans. It's now the official watch party. I dare say we'll be crossing back to Kate Mead all throughout the day as she stays down there. 25 minutes coming up to 25 minutes away from midday. This is The Conversation Hour. My name's Rochelle. You're on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria. Still lots of texts coming through on Cookery the Australian Way and the copies that you have. Rish, I still use it. I'll be making the yo-yos this week. My old one wore out, so I got a new one about 15 years ago. I also bought all of the kids' one. And others saying my son loves to cook, but he's getting his recipes and his ideas from TikTok. He's 13 and he's a really good cook. And I did start the show by saying, do young people still know how to cook if they're living at home longer? Are they taking on the cooking responsibilities in the household, or are they still handballing it to mum or dad or to an older sibling? This, why do young people not need to know how to cook just because they live at home? When they get old enough, they should be taking on and sharing the responsibility of cooking along with other members of the family. So if you've got a teen in your house who cooks, I'd love to hear from you as well. 1-300-222-774. Well, there's been a lot of talk about the death of recipe tin eats. Nagi Mashi is a golden retriever dozer who unfortunately died last week. But Nagi spoke really openly and posted not only about the death of Dozer, but about the fact that she was taking a step back from work when Dozer was palliative, when he was really unwell. She knew he was going to die. So she said, look, that's it. You're not going to hear from me. You're not going to see from me. I'm not going to work. I'm going to take care of Dozer and I'm going to spend these last moments with him. But Nagi's in a position to be able to do that, right? She's lucky enough to be able to do that. Could you? And should you? Should you be able to take leave, take carer's leave for a bereavement of your pet? And maybe it's something that's already being done in your workplace. Or would you just lie? Would you lie to your boss? Well, one law firm, Hive Legal, have actually taken it a step further. They now have legitimised this, and it's called Pawternity. And Melissa Lyon is the executive director and experienced designer at Hive Legal and was behind this. Melissa, The idea of making it okay, legally okay, for employees to take time off to either take a pet to the vet, to grieve for the death of a pet. How's that been going over the last couple of years? Do people actually put their hand up and apply for this leave?
Absolutely, they do. Hi, Rochelle. I'm really happy to be talking about this. Yes, they do. So we have had paternity leave in place at Hive Legal for nearly 5 years now. And yes, I can say it has been used. I think at least on 10 occasions we've had our team apply for the leave to either look after sick pets or to recover after the death of a pet as well. And it actually extends a bit further. We actually allow our team to take leave, paid leave on the adoption of a pet too, so they can settle them in to home. Yeah.
So as Hive Legal, this is a law firm.
Yep.
So law firms, if you think stereotypically, sometimes would probably look their nose down at you if you actually took leave for the death of a loved one. You know, you're expected to work 15, 16 hours, days and around the clock. This is very progressive.
It is. We'd like to think of ourselves as progressive. In fact, I think we can say we are. Yes, look, we established the firm about 12 years ago, Rochelle, and really with the idea of redesigning our business model, the way we work with our clients, and especially the way that we work with our team as well, so that we could give them a really good experience. And part of that is not just about doing the work, but it's how you can actually, I suppose, integrate your work with your life as well. And in terms of this part of our leave policy, it was very much around pets being a big emotional, there's an emotional attachment there with our pets, and giving our team the opportunity to make sure that they're looking after their pets or recovering if something has happened to their pets as well. So, yes, it is progressive.
So has the concept then gained momentum, and the fact that it's a law firm that's done this, so something that everyone understands the principles and the basics and the structure of what a law firm looks like, and they take it very seriously, has that then given clearance for other workplaces to follow suit?
Yes, I think it has. You're right. I mean, really, the legal ecosystem or profession is really quite conservative in the way that things are done too. So I know that when we first introduced this and there was some publicity around it, we did have people inquiring, you know, that is something that we'd like to do as well. How have you done it? How has it worked? So it's really nice, I suppose, to be inspiring these sorts of progressive ways of looking after your team in other workplaces.
Wow. And I wonder if it's happening in other parts around the world as well, Melissa.
Look, I'm not aware of that, Rochelle. I hope it is. I hope it is. And I hope it brings more of that human element to what we do in our workplaces as well, and realising that things that are happening at home have an impact on people at work as well. And you can't necessarily have that complete distinction between what's happening in your home and your workplace. I think the other thing that assisted us in being more progressive in the way that we look at our leave as well as the fact that we've worked hybridly for over 12 years now as a workplace as well. So way before COVID, our team were working or had the choice of either working in the office or from home. And I think when you start to put a different lens on the way that people work and how they can integrate their work and their life, you do start to think about more progressive things like this as well.
Melissa, thank you. Melissa Lyon, Executive Director and Experience Designer at Hive Legal, who a few years ago introduced paternity leave. Yes, paternity leave. You can apply for carer's leave. You can apply for time off if you need to look after a sick pet or if you need to grieve a pet. 1300 222 774. You can text as well, 0437 774 774. What do you think of this idea? If you're an employer, are you okay with this? Michael O'Donoghue is a vet and co-founder of the Pets and People Grief Support Network. Michael, I'm presuming you'd be in favour of something like this.
Absolutely, yeah. Really important, acknowledging people's emotional vulnerability at this time. It only would strengthen the connection to the workplace if they honour the emotional bond that people have with their pets. They're absolutely family, and acknowledging that would be go a long way to bonding themselves to the workplace.
It would, actually, wouldn't it? You would feel understood. It would potentially make you feel more connected to that workplace. And I wonder if it actually attracts people to that workplace if they know that paternity leave is something that is actually offered.
Yeah, no, it's a great benefit. And it just truly acknowledges where people are in their lives, that their pets are absolutely important parts of the family.
Are you seeing, when we watched Nagi speak so openly about Dozer and taking time off, especially when he was palliative, and the things that she did with him and spoke about, whether it just be lying down, eating their favourite food, if he was up for eating, even just taking time out in those final days, is that a part of the grief?
Yeah, we can call that anticipatory grief, that, you know, that the grief starts to build as we get a diagnosis of a terminal illness from the vet. The grief begins. And then, there's often a lot of intensity around palliative care, that you're giving your pet lots of medicine and you're making difficult decisions about whether to continue treatment or, spend a fortune pursuing options. So, there's a lot of high emotional demand at that time, and but also, busy cherishing the moments with your pet. And then, when the final decision comes, there's like a new wave of actual grief when the dog passes. Mm.
Michael, thank you. Michael O'Donoghue, vet and co-founder for the Pets and People Grief Support Network. I cannot keep up with the calls and the texts on Cookery, the Australian Way, the addition that you have, the dishes that you still cook out of it. But whether or not there is someone in your house doing food studies, if you've just joined us, we started the program by talking about the fact that food studies is now in the top 5 fastest growing VCE subjects. So what is it about food studies? It's more than just cooking. And how young do you need to be to know how to cook? Should you be able to produce a meal for the family? 14? 15?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is the Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Oh, the dishes from Cookery the Australian Way. Remember them all? Golden syrup dumplings, lamb roast, yo-yo biscuits. There is a lot of love for Cookery the Australian Way. Malcolm's called through from Mount Waverley. Now, Malcolm, I believe you have a very strong connection to this book that people have an absolute love for.
The book's kind of been part of my life forever. When I was young, my auntie started writing the book, and there were 4 of them started the book, and Shirley's the only one still going, and she's currently in a nursing home. But
Back up. Your auntie, Shirley Cameron, wrote Cookery the Australian Way.
With 3 other people. There were 4 of them in the first edition, and it quickly became 3, and then it became 2, and Shirley's the only one still standing. And so the first edition, I had one last week. I gave it to my brother, because we've got a couple here in the house. And so the book evolved over time, because the one that Shirley likes talking about is the Lemon Delicious, because in the first one it had a bucket load of sugar,
mm-hmm.
and trends changed, the sugar content went down. But the book she loved the most was the one that was the metric edition, because everybody had to buy a new one.
I've had quite a few people just texting in the two words, Lemon Delicious. So your aunt Shirley is not alone. So did you ever go to like Christmas at her place? Like, where, if you went
no,
to
she
the
came to Christmas at our place.
That would have been stressful, given that your auntie was like, the founder of Cookery the Australian Way. Was she a great cook?
She was. Yeah, she enjoyed cooking, and she enjoyed new products. Yeah. I went to a dinner with her over 10 years ago, put on by Macmillan's, because the book had been in print for 40 years, and it was this. There was another book on. It was another book there at the same time, and it was, I think it was Elizabeth Chong's one, and they were the longest running continuous publications by Macmillan.
Yeah, and she's Shirley, a legend too.
And Shirley's book was up to 800,000 copies then. And wow. It's still in print.
I love just finding out these little bits of history that we all have. So just finally, so you said that your Aunt Shirley is in an aged care home at the moment,
but there was
something to do with the Christmas Bake Off where they may or may not have used her.
What happened is that because Shirley had access to buying books at a wholesale price as the author, and so I bought 10 copies for her a couple of years ago just to give away as she wanted to, and there's still one in her room, and the staff often talk about the book, and the nursing home she's in, there's 8 facilities in Melbourne, and they decided to have a Christmas Bake Off in the nursing homes, and they made White Christmas out of the book.
Next time you see her, Malcolm.
She was having a great day because the photographer was there for her.
Can you please let her know the next time that you see her that quite literally she has broken our text line, that the phone board has been lit up all lines pretty much the entire morning, that what they've learnt, what they love, and the fact that people still cook from that book. So can you let her know how loved she is?
Yes, I will. Because it's a practical book. And one of the things that's in the book that's not in a lot of cookbooks is how to fix something if it's wrong.
Yes.
Where did I go wrong?
Yeah.
And it gives you some suggestions as to where you went wrong.
Well, you have a legend in the family. Malcolm, thank you so much for calling through. Oh, my goodness, this thing. You definitely need to interview Shirley. I know. Could you imagine, though, cooking for her from that book and then serving it to her? Oh, getting sweaty even just thinking about it. The chocolate self-sourcing pudding, that was my favourite as well. So many, Rish, I still use Cookery the Australian Way. Absolutely. I use it all the time. And many who have lost their copies and are on a search for it and are going to go and find it. So if it's not Cookery the Australian Way that you're looking out for, it might be the Winter Olympics. So I don't know about you, but there was someone at about 4:30 this morning in our household watching the television and watching some random skiing or snow event. And is this you? Have you found yourself watching it and drawn to it? It's incredible because you've got the high adrenaline. There's the fascination with trying to figure out how somebody learns to do what they can do. But there feels like there's a real momentum at the moment around the Winter Olympics. And Associate Professor Rob Gill is a sports media researcher at Swinburne University. Rob, it feels like there's been a real shift, you know, where the interest, the passion, the pride that we have in the Winter Olympics, it's really gone up a notch, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has, Rochelle. It certainly has. And we can probably thank streaming and digital media content for a lot of that growth in the viewership of the Winter Olympics, but particularly the sports that have that, as you say, adrenaline, but that high risk involved with them too.
So when we think about the other Olympics, I didn't want to say, the non-Winter Olympics, the traditional Winter Olympics, however you want to frame them.
Summer Olympics,
thank you. That's probably simpler and more apt. You can set the pathways, you know, whether it be athletics or basketball. However, the pathways for the Winter Olympics seem trickier, harder, whether it be geography, the amount of snow, being able to learn to do some of the tricks that these people do. Are the pathways just vastly different?
Well, particularly for Australian competitors, yes, particularly those that are reliant on snow and good snow, that obviously our Australian snowboarding, skiing teams, they need good snow. We get about maybe 6 weeks, maybe 2 months, maybe even 2.5 at a stretch in Australia of a good ski season where they can actually go and compete on our local slopes. Otherwise, they've got to head up to the Northern Hemisphere and train and live and operate and compete away from their homeland, away from their family, maybe their loved ones. For a big part of each year. So it's certainly a different pathway for the Australians, And it's a bit of a harder slog for the Australians based on the fact that, you know, they don't have that support network, family support network around them.
Which is an issue for other Olympians as well. And you know, unless you're in those sort of top tier swimming, for example, you're not going, there are a lot of Olympians who have to pay their own way, who have second jobs. Is it the same, like, is there money in the Winter Olympics through either sponsorship or sport?
Well, there is now. So it's gone up a couple of notches, very steeply. It's gone up a couple of notches, as I said, because of the stronger digital media content that is now available, and it appeals to that kind of teenage, high teenage, adolescent demographic in terms of how these people perform, how they look while they're performing, the sort of risky things that they do while they perform, the gear that they're wearing as they're doing this performance, and the fact that, I don't know, they just seem so cool and chilled out.
I was going to say that. They're all so cool. I'm watching them all going, oh, my God, I would not have been cool enough to hang out with you. Like, they're all uber cool. And I think there is such an attraction in that as well.
Yep, definitely. And I think it goes with the kind of communities that they hang with at the time. And they're also happy for each other when they are competing, which is often very different to some of the very high professional stakes that happen in the Summer Olympics. So, you know, if you're watching something like, you know, some of the snowboarding, the freestyle snowboarding, some of the ski jumps, and, you know, all the other competitors, they're really wrapped and they're hollering and hooting when somebody lands a really good jump or a really good trick. They almost feel like they're excited for them, even though, in fact, they're probably their competitors.
Yeah, you're right. I actually haven't noticed that, but it's so true. There's a real sense of family and being there to support each other, which you often don't get, especially at that level as well.
Yeah, and it's kind of like they're excited for the sport as much as they're excited for their own performances.
Will it continue, do you think? Is this sort of just the beginning of the momentum, the snowball effect, if you don't mind my terrible pun?
Well, it's hard to predict. You know, as I said, there's been a rapid rise in viewership based on accessibility now, because if I can look at my own experience growing up years ago, it was winter sport and the Winter Olympics was kind of a novelty value. Now it's become a serious pathway for younger people. They can see themselves actually being in the Winter Olympics. They can place themselves in the shoes of some of their, you know, their up and coming stars. And they now see that this is a realistic pathway for them as a professional sport and as a profession, whereas years ago it wasn't available. Will that continue to kick like it's kicked in the last 20 years? Difficult to say because, you know, as I said, the exposure has gone through the roof.
And it's just so exciting to watch, isn't it? And I feel like the momentum has built this year. Rob, thank you. We might touch base with you again because there's a lot to sort of pull apart and to look at those individual sports as well. Associate Professor Rob Gill, sports media researcher at Swinburne University. Only the posh people knew how to ski or even own skis when I was growing up. It was a very foreign world to me. We've been talking about Cookery the Australian Way in this text. I just got out my copy of Cookery the Australian Way. Thank you. You are welcome. Robert's in Seddon. Hi, Robert.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to say?
I was just wanting to make a comment about the popularity of food technology or home economics. And the fact is we have no dedicated training for food technology teachers in any of our teacher training courses at any of our universities. So
really?
It becomes a little bit of a dilemma that we
have. That's what I was wondering earlier when I was speaking to the Principals Association. I was thinking, okay, well, let's take a step back and do we have the teachers? She said there was a shortage, but is the training an issue as well? How do you know that? What do you do, Robert?
Formerly, I'm retired now, but formerly I was teaching the food technology subjects within the teacher training degree.
Mm.
And unfortunately, the universities have decided that they don't want to teach it anymore.
That's going to have to change.
Well, it has to, but trying to get the message through to government is really, really difficult. I mean, we have two very good professional associations for food technology in Victoria and Australia-wide, and even with those advocacy organisations, we cannot seem to get the message through that this is about, it's a health issue as well as it is everything else. We
absolutely.
Have an obesity crisis in this country.
It's not just about learning how to cook. Yeah, absolutely. Robert, I might follow up on that. I find that really interesting. Thank you. Diane's in Mount Eliza. Diane, you're our last call. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. I just wanted to say that I've been using my Nursing Mothers Association cookbook for 55 years, and that's, I've never used the other one, but my Nursing Mothers book has been tattered and I've had to get another one, and it's absolutely fantastic.
So that's your go-to. So you're the lone one here not using Cookery the Australian Way.
I'm the only, no, that's right, no, but it's good because it always had extras you could put in. If you didn't have something, you could put something else.
The switcheroo.
So it was a great help when I was nursing mother.
Oh, I know, right?
Nearly 77 and I still use it.
Oh, that's great. Well, if you have a copy of Cookery the Australian Way, I think you get big bucks for it, Diane. Just saying. Wowee. I had no idea it would be quite this popular. If I didn't get to read out your text on Cookery the Australian Way, I am so sorry. But there are some wonderful dishes and recipes that you're all still using this. Hamburgers, page 138. Yum. All right, go to page 138. I'll speak to you tomorrow. Take care.